Well, I'm not going to tell you something you didn't already know today, except maybe a few points of interest. But it's a subject I think we all understand. The thing is, we rub shoulders every day with people who are of a slightly different persuasion on this subject due to what they've been led to believe by the common religious point of view on this subject. The subject is predestination, but more than just predestination, I want to talk about biblical predestination, because there's a difference between what the world understands and what the Bible presents on the subject. And I want to look at the subject more comprehensively than is perhaps normally done. But we have to understand the era in which this particular belief system came into being. The Protestant Reformation brought forward many novel doctrinal interpretations, not the least of which is the traditional idea of heaven and hell. And I'm sure we all understand that belief system, having been exposed to it on many fronts, some in our history, some simply from our relatives. But out of that area of understanding, other things developed. And there are a few beliefs, I think, that had a more severe and disruptive effect on the evangelical theology than what is commonly taught with regard to the subject of predestination. There were prominent religious personalities that figured heavily in the Reformation of the late 14th and 15th centuries who began a movement, if I guess we could call it that, a movement which was based or structured around a particular understanding. And that understanding causes a lot of people grief even to this day. One in particular, a man named Calvin. He founded a major denomination, and that denomination is, to a great extent, structured around his take on the idea of predestination. And it may not have been entirely his own, because that era grew out of what we call the Dark Ages, in which many beliefs had come into being through the Catholic Church. Most of us have heard of Dante Alighieri and his Divine Comedy, where he developed the idea, or he at least put into print the idea that was prevailing in his day. The idea of people going to hell, in an ever-burning hell, in a very graphic way of presenting it. And that idea has been superimposed onto the belief system of most of Protestant religions, as well as Catholic, because that's basically where it came from. But the Calvinistic thought process was decidedly severe, as most people would see it, posing what appear to be difficult obstacles for those people who are conscious of their personal faults. To a Calvinist, the possibility of becoming converted was very, very limited. The Calvinistic teaching wants us to believe that a person is called of God or not. And if you're not called of God, there is no opportunity for that person to ever become converted, no matter how much they might want to be. That is the fundamental premise of what we could call Calvinistic religions. And there is a certain element in many religions that are somewhat Calvinistic in their teaching. To most Protestant religions, it's fairly absolute that a person is consigned to heaven or hell in this lifetime. There is no second chance to them. Now, we understand it differently. We understand what God's plan is, how he intends to involve all of humanity, at least with respect to allowing them a chance. But the Calvinistic approach is that no, if you're not predestined, you have no opportunity to become converted, no matter how much you may want to be. That thinking prevails in an awful lot of our Protestant religions or Protestant denominations. The idea that some are destined to be called and others are not. Now, there is a hint of truth in that, as we understand it, because, yes, some people are destined to be called now, where the vast majority are not. And that's the disturbing part, too, to a lot of people, that the number of people called, genuinely called in this age, are very few in number. The vast majority have no interest. They're not called. They have no interest in being called. And that would be it if you listen to a lot of our religious teaching. But that's not it, as we realize. But the question is, what is predestination really? What is biblical predestination? What does the Bible teach on this subject? It is mentioned, but it isn't mentioned very often. There's only a couple of verses when that whole idea is built upon. But there's also some glaring omissions in the thought process that created the predestination doctrine. Let's look at some of the scriptures of where they are and where they came from. First, I want to read through an item that I took off the internet with regard to defining predestination as the Calvinists would define it. This is from John Calvin, Calvin's own writing. He was an influential French theologian and pastor during the Protestant Reformation. He was a principal figure in the development of the system of Christian theology later called Calvinism. Originally trained as a humanist lawyer, he broke from the Roman Catholic Church around 1530. Calvin's writing and preachings provided the seeds for the branch of theology that bears his name. The Reformed Church, the Congregational Church, and the Presbyterian churches, which look to Calvin as the chief expositor of their beliefs, have spread throughout the world. According to John Calvin, predestination is God's unchangeable decree from before the creation of the world. Listen carefully to this. According to John Calvin, predestination is God's unchangeable decree, and that's the key, from before the creation of the world, that he would freely save some people, called the elect, for ordaining them to eternal life, while others, the reprobates, would be barred from access to salvation and sentenced to eternal death. According to Calvin, people are sentenced to eternal death before they're even born. Think about that. Is that biblical, really? Calvin described the basis of predestination in several ways. In general, he affirmed that there is no basis for election outside of God, referring to Ephesians 1:9. Calvin noted that God purposed election in himself, basing his decree on the predestination of nothing outside himself. Calvin attributed the salvation of the dead to God's free decision to favor them. He variously described this as God's mere generosity, his freely given mercy, and the good pleasure of his will. referring to Ephesians 1:5. Moreover, Calvin based the damnation of the reprobate solely in God's decision. In other words, God alone would identify people that he was going to condemn, apparently with or without merit. Continuing, since God's reasons for predestination are wholly internal to his being, they are opaque to humanity. In other words, we can't understand it. Ultimately, then, the basis of God's predestination is mysterious and utterly incomprehensible to people. This mystery points to one of God's purposes in predestination, to inspire wonder and reverence in believers. The things hidden in God are not to be understood by people, but rather revered in their wonderful depth. Despite the mysterious basis of predestination, it is possible for the elect to be certain of their status as children of God. The first and seemingly most important indicator of the election is what Calvin referred to as the calling of God. His use of this term seems to refer to a subjective inward certainty that God has chosen a person for salvation. A lot of things in this presentation, but I think the most important is that there is no choice on the part of the individual in this. And that is disturbing to some people. Let's look at the scriptures that apply to this subject. There are not a lot where it's translated predestination per se, but there's a lot of places where the original Greek is used, but translated differently. Using an Englishman's Greek concordance as opposed to a Strong's concordance or something, we find the translated word predestinate or predestined to have several other translations. The Greek word is proruro, or prorurizo. Strong's number 4308 and 4309, which is translated a number of ways. In each of these verses, the word is used. Acts 2:25, where it says, "For David speaks concerning him, I foresaw the Lord always before my face, for he is on my right hand, that I should not be moved." The word foresaw is the same word as is elsewhere translated predestined. But these various translations give you the picture as to what this word actually means. It has a broader definition than maybe just that the word as it's understood, because people hear the word and they understand its definition using the sense of what they've always been told about predestination, which is the Calvinistic approach. The Bible's different. Acts 21:29 is another place where the word is used. Acts 21:29, "For they had seen before with him in the city Trophimus and Ephesian, whom they supposed that Paul had brought into the temple." The word supposed is this same word. Acts 4:28. Where it says, "For to do whatsoever that but thy hand and thy counsel determined before to be done." Determined before is the same word that is elsewhere translated predestined. Determined before, in other words, a decision to do something in advance of it being done. Romans 8:29 and 30 are the big ones here. And it's Romans 8:29 and 30 where a lot of the predestination idea is drawn from. Romans 8:29. "For whom he did foreknow, he also did predestinate to be conformed to the image of his Son, that he might be the firstborn among many brethren. Moreover, whom he did predestinate, them he also called. And whom he called, them he also justified. And whom he justified, them he also glorified. Now let's keep that verse in mind. We're going to come back to it in a little while. But it gives us a different sense of what it means than the Calvinistic point of view would give us. 1 Corinthians 2:7 is another place where the original Greek word for predestined is used. 1 Corinthians 2:7, "But we speak the wisdom of God in a mystery, even the hidden wisdom which God ordained before the world unto our glory." Now this is another verse that Calvinists use, as I read earlier, that a person's salvation or lack of opportunity, therefore, was determined from the beginning, before they were even born. That's where they get that idea. Is that what that really says? Ephesians 1:5 is another place where it says, "Having predestinated us unto the adoption of children by Jesus Christ to himself, according to the good pleasure of his will." And then over a few verses, Ephesians 1:11, "In whom also we have obtained an inheritance, being predestinated according to the purpose of him who works all things after the counsel of his own will." It's just from these few mentions that the predestination teaching developed, that has shaped a lot of Christian theology. But can we get the sense of the Calvinistic point of view from these verses? We can see that there's a lot of conjecture on their part, because do these really say what they say it means? When a person is predestined, what does that indicate? Let's go back to some of these verses. I think I'll do it now. Romans 8:29, for example, we read that one. But what this really says is not the predestination in the sense of someone being selected for a calling as opposed to someone not. "For whom he did foreknow, he also predestinated to be conformed to the image of his Son." What that's effectively saying is, God isn't going to call a bunch of people to conversion and then at the end say, "Well, what do I do with them now?" No, God has already determined what those who are called are going to become. It isn't a matter of who is called and who isn't. It's a matter of those who are called, what are they to become? And they're to become conformed to the image of his Son. We're going to be created after the likeness of Jesus Christ. That's the important difference. That he might be the firstborn among many brethren. That reinforces that what I just said. He's the firstborn, and we're to be the laterborn of that genre. Predestination is referring to our destiny, not the origin of our calling. You see the difference? Verse 30 continues the thought, and it reinforces that thought. "Moreover, whom he did predestinate, them he also called. And whom he called, them he also justified. And whom he justified, them he also glorified." There is a process here. Our calling, our justification, and then our glorification. God has predetermined in advance what we will become. It isn't a predetermination in the same sense as is commonly understood, discerning between who will be called and who will not. Now, there is a process that determines who will be called and who will not, but it's not predestination per se. There's another aspect of that, again, this world doesn't understand. But we understand it because it's illustrated in the pattern of God's holy days. this idea of predestination, as the world understands it, not only influences perceptions of the process of salvation, but also shapes one's perceptions of God and His mercy, or seeming lack thereof. The major point of this teaching, some refer to it as a doctrine, but the major point of this teaching is that certain individuals were known or chosen in advance by God for salvation, even long before their birth, while the rest, obviously the vast majority, have no chance whatsoever. Now, is that consistent with the biblical teaching? What about that verse that says, God is not willing that any should perish? Wouldn't the idea that a pre-decision made with regard to the majority of people that consigns them to damnation in advance, how does that square with God's will that none perish? God is not willing that any should perish. It's obviously a contradiction of His very nature and His stated purpose. God is not willing that any should perish. But the thing is, He's created a plan by which none would perish needlessly. I'm not saying that there aren't those who will, but they will have earned it. It's not something assigned to them without merit. And that throws a light on how people understand God and His plan. From these above verses, we can discern a little more than predestinationalists would want to admit. First, there is a foreknowledge in God's part, but it's not a rigidly unalterable consignment to damnation of the great majority. That's not what the foreknowledge is about. God knows who can be called in this age. This is a tough age. We've got society that's corrupt. We've got Satan influencing the minds and thoughts of so many people. This is a tough time to be called. God knows that. He wouldn't call somebody now, in this time, that He knows wouldn't make it. Even among the religious Jews of His time, the scriptures say He blinded them lest they should understand. Why? That He might have mercy upon them. Now, how is blinding them merciful? There's only one possible answer. He blinds them so that they won't lose their opportunity, knowing that they wouldn't make it now. That's the difference. Biblical predestination is not exclusionary, though that's a major component in Calvinistic reasoning. Secondly, those who are predestined, it is their destiny that is determined, not necessarily their calling and not necessarily their success, because people called don't always make it. We know that. We have to toe the line. We have to remain obedient. We have to remain zealous. We have to remain in possession of God's Spirit. We have to grow in grace and knowledge. Someone who just simply neglects their calling aren't necessarily going to make it. So predestination, if it simply means a guaranteed call, or it means that a person is called excluding anyone else, it doesn't work logically. It isn't a matter of whether a person is called. It's a matter of what they will be fashioned into. That's how that predestination is used in the New Testament. Ephesians 1:5 conveys some of the same idea. Our destiny is to become spirit-born sons in the family of God. That is what we are predestined to. not whether or not we're predestined to be called. There's an important distinction there. In other words, God has fully thought out his plan and purpose of salvation in advance. The whole plan is laid out in his own mind and in his word of what he is doing. The major area where predestination has missed the point is in their failure to understand that there is 2 days of salvation. In God's holy days, there are pictured 2 distinct harvests. And we understand the first harvest and the first resurrection. And we understand the second harvest at the end of days, the end of time for humanity. Most Protestant religions hang their hat on there being just 1 day of salvation. Today, now, this is the only time of salvation as far as they're concerned. And that's true with regard to those who are called as saints. But as we know from God's plan, there is another day of salvation. And without that thought in mind, without that realization, their whole picture can't come clear. Missing that particular detail, they're forced to see that the vast majority are consigned to never being given any opportunity. If there's only 1 day of salvation, as they say, what about all the rest? When could they ever become converted? The Calvinist would say it's impossible. Is that God's plan? That's what we need to know. That's what we need to understand. When we realize that there is more than 1 day of salvation, the whole picture of predestination changes. And in understanding a second day of salvation, we must understand God's plan with respect to the resurrections. The resurrections are also a major biblical component that is left out of most religion. Some will acknowledge the resurrections, but they don't understand what they're for or when they occur, other than perhaps the first. Most religions understand the first, but that's about as far as it goes. What's the reason for a second resurrection? Some could say, well, that's for sentencing at the end. But I thought that happens at death, doesn't it? The premise that this is the only day of salvation and that a person can only come to God if they're called, if they're predestined to be saved, that gives a lot of people fits of anxiety, thinking about their relatives or their friends who may have never expressed any interest at all in becoming converted. What of them? You can see why people would be anxious about it. A number of religions have come up with explanations that address this particular anxiety, but are they valid? Do they really answer their questions? It might be wise to back up a little bit at this point and ask, how can someone be called? We know from John 6:44 that a calling is specific. A calling is of God. A calling is of God the Father. No man can come unto him unless the Spirit of God draw him, as we read in John 6:44. That would reinforce the predestination's point of view to a point, except for the fact that there is another period of time that we read of just a chapter later in John 7:37 and 8, which is reinforced by Revelation 22:17. Let's look at those. John 7:37. And this is obviously referring to the fall holy day season. John 7:37, in the last day, that great day of the feast, Jesus stood and cried, saying, "If any man thirst, let him come unto me and drink. He that believes on me, as the Scripture has said, out of his belly shall flow rivers of living water. But this spoke he of the Spirit, which they that believe on him should receive, for the Holy Spirit was not yet given." This idea contradicts the predestinationist's point of view that a person can't choose themselves to be called. John 6:44, which is tied to the spring holy day season, would seem to suggest that no one can come unless the Father identifies that person and calls that person. But here in a different season, we're given a different picture, where it's obvious that a person can choose whether or not to come to him. Furthering that thought, Revelation 22:17. Revelation 22. We can see that there's a period of time that is what some Protestants refer to as the idea of whosoever wills may come. There's a prominent hymn, a well-known hymn that carries that line. 22, Revelation 22:17, and the Spirit and the Bride say, "Come." And let him that heareth say, "Come." And let him that is athirst come. And whosoever will, let him take of the water of life freely. The very subject that we just read in John chapter 7. But notice here, the Spirit and the Bride say, "Come." When we understand the time setting of this verse, we realize that it is into the millennial age, when the bride is already working with Christ, already as spirit beings. The patriarch and the matriarch of the family bringing other children into the family of God. And whosoever wills may freely access themselves to the opportunity for salvation. There is a period of time when whosoever wills may come. When is that? If this is the only day of salvation, when is that? Obviously, it isn't. There's another day, and that day is reserved for those whom God will call later, in the later harvest. There's more than one day of salvation. That's the important thing that most Protestant religions don't understand. To them, it's just today. And you can understand much of their pitch being based on that premise. That's what's missing, for the most part. They don't understand the resurrections, and they don't understand another day of salvation, which will involve the vast majority. Of those who are predestined, and let's say there are people who are predestined or predetermined to be called now, those people, Jeff reminded me last night, those people have no choice to remain among those who aren't called. If a person is called, this is their time, this is their day. I knew of someone back in the church in the early 70s. One brother was called and the other knew the truth, was exposed to the church. But he decided, "Well, I'll wait and be called later. It'll be easier. That way I can live my life now as I please and God will call me later." How do we know he wasn't being called now? He knew enough. Did he have the option of saying, "No, I'll be called later"? kind of dangerous territory, I would say. If he was being called at that time and he chose to reject it, I think we know that he won't have another chance if that was the case. But there is a whosoever wills period of time. It's coming. It's not now necessarily. Among those of us who know the truth, we do have some choice as to whether to respond or not. But most people are disinterested, and God has blinded them for a particular reason, that he might call them in an easier time. That time of whosoever wills will occur after the second coming in the millennial age and the age beyond. How we know that predestination, as it's understood by the Calvinists, can't be correct is a very simple answer. And that answer is that all are destined to be called. It's a matter of when. So the idea of predestination being a selection process where only certain ones can be saved and the rest have no chance, they have no option, they have no choice, that idea is bogus because there is a time when they will be called. God has mercifully put them into the point, into that period of time when it's going to be much easier. Satan will be bound. Society will be going the right way. The deception and perversions of this age won't be there. And if anyone is not converted at that time, it's entirely their own fault. That's the difference. We could use a term, and it's not in the Bible, but we could use the term predestined and postdestined. Predestined being those that are selected by God the Father to be called in this age, and the postdestined, those who are destined to be called later in the millennial age. And if we understand predestination in that that process, it helps us understand better what predestination is. To wrap this up, let's consider some of the apparent incongruities in the Calvinistic theological thought process. Calvinism makes God out to be insensitive to the vast majority, has no concern that they're condemned forever with no hope. It makes God out to be insensitive to the vast majority, consigning them to eternal damnation before they're even born. Is that really the God of the Bible? Secondly, it undermines the whole basis of judgment. Why subject the unconverted to a condemned judgment if they were never given any choice in the matter? Who's responsible for their condemnation? If God assigned them to that, isn't God partly responsible for their failure? There's a lot of things that don't work when you think through this very carefully. Another point, it disregards God's basic intent, being not willing that any should perish. How could he say that unless it were true? God is not willing that any should perish. Calvinism presents God as unfathomably mysterious, not ever revealing his purpose to mankind, where he claims to do just the opposite, as we read in John 15:15. God has revealed his plan very clearly when we understand the entirety of the New Testament and the sense of what it presents to us. Calvinistic theology fails to realize that there are two harvest periods in the redemption process of humanity. It fails to factor in the reasons for the resurrections, whether it acknowledges them or not. It fails to factor in why resurrections of humanity in mass are necessary. They're necessary, a necessary part of the plan. But most importantly, the common predestination teaching is wrong because all are destined to be called. It's just a matter of when. So to say predestination means some are destined to be called and others are not is wrong right from the get-go, because all are destined to be called in their proper time frame, in the time frame that God assigns to them, that time frame which will provide them the greatest possibility of reward or the easiest time to become born as sons of Christ and his bride. And of those who are called in this age, those predestined to be among God's first fruits, we always need to keep in mind it's not a foregone conclusion that we will be successful. Diligence is necessary. Working together with the power of God's Spirit in us is essential. While our opportunity period is open, it is still required that we make right choices to overcome sin in our lives, to receive and employ God's Holy Spirit as we pursue the perfection called for in such places as we read in Hebrews 6. We may not fathom the reasons for our being called now. Whether we understand those reasons in this lifetime remains to be seen. But as for us, there is no second chance. This is our day of salvation.